Welcome to the Green Minds podcast, the podcast dedicated to thought-provoking conversations on climate change and sustainability. Today, I'm honored to be joined by Jahan Chaudhary, currently lead for environment and climate at the IFAD. The IFAD is the International Fund for Agricultural Development and was founded in 1977 as one of the many UN agencies. Jahan has an incredible career and has held key positions in international climate finance, such as working with the Green Climate Fund and on the NDC partnership. So really an inspiring career in international climate finance, and I'm very excited to delve into this conversation. Thank you so much for accepting this invitation.
Thank you very much.
I've briefly mentioned the positions you held throughout your career, but can you quickly explain what you did prior to joining the IFAD and what got you into the international climate space?
Sure. So I started my career focusing on development finance, mainly working with finance and planning ministries, trying to understand where the growth can come from, what are the sectors that we should really focus on, how we can ensure that a country is accelerating its GDP growth. I focused heavily on East Africa, particularly on Rwanda, where our ambition was to ensure that there is a double-digit growth overall. So my focus was at the national level planning, budgeting, medium-term expenditure framework, fiscal decentralization. So the key focus, I would say, was growth, growth, growth at any cost. And the focus shifted from growth to having more sustainable growth. And that was the beginning of my journey when it comes to environment. So back in 2010, 2009, it was mainly focused on environment. Climate was not necessarily a key part of the jargon that we would be using. So I was focusing mainly on ensuring that environment can be mainstreamed into the government's planning and budgeting process. And I always had this perspective of finance ministry. So how environment can actually be beneficial for economic growth rather than an opposition to economic growth. So that has been my perspective and trying to bring finance ministry more into the environment agenda. Then I looked into climate, and that was mainly focusing on how to establish national climate funds as a pooling mechanism. So you bring various different resources from different partners, but rather than having multiple projects implemented by multiple entities, is it possible for the government to pool all the resources and the government then decide how they're going to be using the resources, how they're going to be tracking, and how they're going to be reporting. So essentially using government systems and processes rather than external systems and processes. And now I'm focusing on agricultural finance, working for IFAD, but of course trying to see how agriculture and climate can be linked. Of course, there's no question that they are linked, but my job is to ensure that 40% of IFAD's core resources is spent on climate or can be qualified as climate finance. So as of today, the amount is approximately $1.4 billion. So that's what I'm really focusing on, and I'm also trying to see how best to assemble finance from different angles and making sure that there's a collective impact that could happen. So it's not just necessarily IFAD's resources, but how we can blend resources from other organizations. Yeah, so that's me, starting from development finance to climate finance to where I am now, agricultural finance.
Amazing. Thank you for this answer. You know, doing this podcast is always really interesting to see the career path of different guests. And it's never, you know, one simple answer. I chose to do that and I did that. So it's really refreshing to hear as a student always and see how opportunities can actually forge your career path. So super interesting. And you talked a lot about governments and climate spending. So I want to come back on that. I know that you worked on the NDC partnership. So the NDCs, for our listeners, are the nationally determined contributions. I have this definition from the UNFCCC, and they basically embody the efforts by each country to reduce national emissions and to adapt to the impact of climate change. Can you explain what do the NDCs consist in? And if you can maybe illustrate with a concrete example of what they might look like.
Yeah, sure. So nationally determined contributions. Let me first dispel the myth. Oftentimes it is perceived as a document that is focused on mitigation. It is not. It also looks heavily into adaptation. So it's a combination of mitigation and adaptation. So what an NDC ideally should include, what is your overall ambition when it comes to reduction of GHG emission over the short term, medium term? It also tries to build the bridge between NDCs, which would essentially be considered as medium-term plan, with long-term planning, which is your long-term strategy for a low emission up to 2050. So NDCs is trying to bridge that gap between medium-term strategy and that long-term strategy. So once you have determined what the ambition actually looks like, then you basically say how you are going to be delivering on the ambition. So you identify your priority sectors and you try to then pinpoint the potential mitigation benefit coming out of each of these sectors. But at the same time, what are the resilience measures that various different sectors are actually going to be adopting? So for example, when it comes to resilience or adaptation, you look heavily on water, you look into health, you look into agriculture. And when you are thinking about mitigation, you know, the key sectors are AFALU, which is essentially agricultural, forestry, and land use. You're looking into transportation. You're looking into energy, which is a big component of your mitigation chapter. So the idea is to have a light touch on how you're going to be delivering on the target through various different sectors. Then, of course, it is important to identify the cost requirement. What exactly is going to cost to implement your how across various different sectors? And then you can divide that cost across two different categories, what you would call conditional and unconditional. And unconditional is essentially the government is using its own fiscal space to invest, and also the private sector locally can invest. And when it comes to your conditional commitment, it essentially means that you're relying on foreign direct investment, you're relying on ODA, you're relying on investment also from the private sector, external private sector entities. So that's what would constitute your overall costing. And finally, you give an indication in terms of how you're going to be tracking the progress, which is essentially your MRV, monitoring, reporting, and verification. So these are, I would say, key ingredients of a good quality NDCs. It has to be smart, it has to be costed, and the roles and responsibilities have to be clearly laid out.
Really clear. I like how you divided in, you know, big steps, have a overall ambition, have a sectoral approach, and then what are the costs and requirements for these targets that you set within the sectors, and then track and progress. So really a clear method for each countries. Can you maybe explain to us how do countries come up with NDCs? What are the process behind them? And is there anyone who needs to approve the NDCs, or it's just up to the country to decide what the NDC is going to look like?
Yeah, so I would say five things to look out for. First, the process is as important as the product. Obviously, when it comes to delivering on your NDC targets, there are various different sectors that are going to be involved and will be impacted. So it is very important to get the buy-in of various different sectors. And it is not only the sectors, general population would also be impacted. So if you're suddenly thinking about, okay, I want to ensure that the renewable energy percentage in your total energy distribution would go up, how does that impact the lifestyle of the general population? How does that impact the expenditure of the general population? What kind of incentives are you going to be creating for the private sector to make this happen? So there are various different players who are going to be impacted. So it is very important to bring them in this dialogue, in the discussion early on. So what I would call a whole of society approach. Okay, so that's first. Second, it is also very important to ensure that the finance ministries and planning ministries are involved from the very beginning of the process, because on their own, they will never be implemented. They have to be mainstreamed across the national strategy, across the sectoral development plans, across the national budget, across the medium-term expenditure framework. So you can say what you want to say in an NDCs, but unless this is mainstreamed across the national and subnational documents, it is never going to be implemented. So to make sure that this is mainstreamed, you need to bring the finance and planning ministries on board. Third is, it's important to raise the level of ambition, but we also need to be cautious about not to plan to fail. So the level of ambition is important because it gives a signal to the world about the seriousness of a country to implement the Paris Agreement. However, we have to make sure that that level of ambition is realistic given the fiscal space the country have, given the ODA flow that they're seeing, given the foreign direct investment that they're seeing. So often there is, I would say, lack of alignment between the fiscal situation and the ambition that you see in the country's NDCs. And that can create a lot of implementation challenges. So that's, I would say, the third part, making sure that what you're saying in terms of ambition is realistic in the short term, medium term, and long term, as far as your fiscal situation is concerned. The fourth, roles and responsibilities have to be very clear. Because anybody's business becomes nobody's business. So who are those ministries that have to take the charge? What is the coordination mechanism that you have actually established, not only to prepare the NDCs, but also to coordinate the implementation of the NDCs? And here the message is very clear. Let's make sure that we are using national systems and processes for coordination rather than inventing a new coordination mechanism. A lot of these countries would already have coordination mechanism in place, coordination amongst the sectors, between the sectors, as well as coordination with the development partners. So let's have the roles and responsibilities very clear, and let's make sure that we're using the national coordination mechanism. And the fifth, I would say, is important to demonstrate the results. And important to understand what are the lessons that we have learned from the first generation of the NDCs when you're preparing your second generation of NDCs. So there needs to be a loop. These are the results that we need to make visible, and it's important for the countries to make those results visible, because only those visible results can bring more investment, but also what worked and importantly, what did not work. And the lessons that we are getting from those should feed back into the design loop for the next generation of NDCs.
Very interesting. I want to come back on what you were saying about conditional and unconditional NDCs. So basically, conditional NDCs depend on a level of foreign investments. And that kind of ties back to a notion which is common but differentiated responsibilities. It's something that we hear a lot on climate discussions, basically acknowledging different capabilities and responsibilities in mitigating climate change. Do you think that the common but differentiated responsibility concept is well reflected in the NDCs?
So if I want to respond to that question, I first need to understand what does it mean common but differentiated responsibility, okay? Differentiated responsibility does not have any floor, neither it has got any ceiling. So it is up to the country's interpretation to decide what would be the scope and boundary of that differentiated responsibility? Of course, there is a common indicator, and that is if you're a high emitter, you are more responsible. And if you're a low emitter, you're less responsible. But what is that extent of that responsibility is not very clear. So what I see in many of the indices, for example, it's a common responsibility, differentiated, yes, but sometimes that differentiation is very skewed. So for example, you'll have seeds who have got highly ambitious indices, yet they are contributing very little to the global emission. And then you have some very high emitting countries. And when it comes to responsibility in form of the NDC's implementation or ambition, you don't necessarily see that level of responsibility. So again, it is up to the country's interpretation. Of course, you have a common parameter, but how you apply that parameter in terms of, if I'm a high emitting country, I have more responsibility. If I'm a low emitting country, I have lower responsibility. How do you actually practically apply that is not super clear.
Okay, I understand. So a hard concept to apply concretely into the framework. Now that we've set the scenes on what are the nationally determined contribution, I want to know what is the role of the NDC partnership into helping countries implement the NDCs, and what did you do during the 4 years that you worked in the partnership?
Okay, so I would say that there are three responsibilities, and the framework is based on that. We want to increase or enhance the aid effectiveness. Okay, so if you go back to 2005, you would have heard a concept called Paris Aid Effectiveness Principles, which essentially meant that there is a dual accountability. The aid has to be result-based. It has to be transparent. You are supposed to use the country's system and processes, and it has to be programmatic to the extent possible. I think the tragedy is that when it comes to the implementation of the Paris Agreement, we have failed to deploy the Paris Aid Effectiveness Principles. So oftentimes you will see that the aid is projectized, meaning that we are implementing too many projects, too many players, too many development partners, not necessarily providing sectoral budget support or general budget support, essentially going to the national treasury, and that the country then decides how they want to use it rather than predetermined by the development partners. You also see that there's not enough predictability in terms of climate finance or overall aid in general. You also see that it is not necessarily a dual accountability. It is an accountability mainly focused on recipient countries. So the idea was that how can we change that framework when it comes to NDC partnership? So we were doing three things. The first of all, we wanted to ensure that we follow a programmatic approach. So when it comes to NDC, you have the strategy part, you have the legal part, you have the planning part, you have the budgeting part, you have the investment part, and you have the monitoring review and verification part, right? So various different parts, but is it possible for us to consider those elements as a value chain of services? Yeah, so you start from the left, you look into the legal framework, you focus on the policy, you focus on strategy, and as you progress towards the right, you look into investment plans, bankable projects, monitoring review and verification. So what we did, we first came up with that value chain of services. And then we thought, okay, how the institutional members can be placed across this value chain of services? Who has the comparative advantages to offer what to the countries? So if it's about designing bankable projects, who are those international organizations, civil society organizations, who are best placed to offer those kind of services? So we kind of did a mapping and to try to understand who can do what. So that's the basis of making it very clear to the countries what services are available. Second, based on the services, we basically generated requests for support from the countries. Okay, so the countries mainly our focal points were somebody from finance ministry and somebody from environment ministry, and they would send us a request for support letter. And that request for support letter would be circulated across various different implementing entities that we have in our membership network. And it would be their responsibility to respond to that request for support. So what we were trying to do, we were essentially working as a clearinghouse. It's essentially a matchmaker between demand for services and supply of services. Okay, so we try to ensure that it is all better coordinated between the developing countries and the development partners. The third thing that we try to do is we also try to ensure that it is not only just the services that we are offering, but we also keep ourselves relevant in terms of what is actually needed. So we designed new financing instruments to support the countries to update their NDCs. So oftentimes you will see that our institutional members did not necessarily have the resources. So even though they had the comparative advantage, they didn't have the resources. So we would deploy the resources to those partners to offer these services to the countries. We also initiated something called greening the financial system that was targeting the central banks. And the reason why we thought it would be important is because, you know, oftentimes we also see what the financial system says is very different than what the NDCs say. So how do we converge what the financial system actually wants and what the NDCs want? And who would be a better player than central bank in terms of monetary policies to make this connection work? So that was something that we initiated with the central banks of approximately 32 countries, if I'm not mistaken. So the third part was to keep on innovating and to keep on responding to emerging country requests. So yeah, that was NDC partnership.
Really interesting how you mapped sort of the value chain of services and tried to have an impact where you could have one. I read the NDC synthesis report that was published by UNFCCC in November 2023. They basically synthesized 168 available NDCs. So the report states that full implementation of the latest NDCs is estimated to lead to a 5.3% reduction in emissions by 2030 relative to 2019. And so when we look at the scenarios by the IPCC to limit global warming to 1.5 degree with no or limited overshoot, we should be aiming at something like 43% reduction of GHG emissions. So yeah, we're seeing quite a mismatch between the NDCs and the Paris objectives. And reaching the Paris Agreement implies, you know, progressive ramp up of ambition of the NDCs. You talked about the level of ambition. It should be, you know, realistic, but also aiming to achieve the Paris Agreement. So what do you think is needed to ramp up the ambition and to actually meet the Paris Agreement and have NDCs be aligned with that? How do you see that play out?
Yeah, okay. So I would say you would need three things. First is the NDCs have to be smart. Okay, NDCs have to send a market signal that enabling environment is there, investment opportunities are there, and the governments are very serious about bringing the private sector in. Okay, so use that as almost like your pitch to attract the private sector. So that's the first thing. But in order for us to bring the private sector and unlock the financing of the private sector, it is very important to deploy what I would call credit enhancement instruments. Essentially, you can look into providing upfront grant to conduct pre-feasibility, feasibility studies, because private sector, they do not necessarily want to invest on this kind of studies. They want to understand what is the potential. So if you can invest from the public sector on pre-feasibility, feasibility study, share the outcomes with the private sector, depending on the potential, there is going to be more interest, likely interest from the private sector. Second, it is important also for us to think about the provision of guarantee, which is essentially a risk mitigation instrument. There are a lot of risk out there. Paris Agreement is something new. this is a new landscape that the private sector has to deal with. They haven't necessarily been exposed to various different risk factors in many of the developing countries, yet they are interested to invest. But for investment to actually happen, it is important for the public sector to deploy this risk mitigation instruments. So there's more incentive for the private sector to come in. Blended financing instruments. So how, for example, the private sector financing can be blended with the public sector financing. If I'm using my government fiscal space of, let's say, $100 million, then that could potentially attract another $500 million coming from the private sector. And it is important to blend that resources, you know, either in form of equity or other type of financial instruments. Third, I think we need to continue to think about innovation when it comes to financial instruments, whether that has to do with debt for nature swap or issuing more green bonds or thinking about a completely new asset class. So for example, you have carbon credit. Can we think about resilience credit that could be used for adaptation measures? Is it possible for us to monetize the adaptation benefits? So again, it can give a market signal to the private sector entities that, look, these benefits are there, and these benefits can also generate revenue and provide you with a market return. So I think those are the three things. Let's make sure that the NDCs are used as a pitch document to attract the private sector. Let's make sure that we are deploying risk mitigation instruments, credit enhancement instruments to attract the private sector. And let's continue to innovate to bring more private sector in.
Fantastic. Super interesting insights. Thank you so much, Dahan. I think this was very helpful, at least for me, in understanding what the NDCs concretely mean and what are some mechanisms behind their design and also what is needed to ramp up ambition. So super important framework to have in mind. So thank you so much for that. In the interest of time, I also want to talk about your current role at the IFAD. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
IFAD, yes. So the IFAD was founded in 1977. It's a specialized agency of the UN, and it's the only multilateral development institution that focuses on transforming agriculture, rural economies, and food systems. So can you talk us through what does the IFAD do and what is your role within that organization?
Sure. So IFAD is a UN organization. At the same time, it is an IFI, International Financial Institute. So essentially, we offer concessional as well as ordinary loans to our member states, mainly our developing countries. And against this, we have certain objectives. One of the key objectives that we try to meet is focusing on rural economy and trying to ensure that we are reaching the last mile. And last mile in this case means smallholder farmers. So if you think about smallholder farmers, they're actually generating 1/3 of the world's food. And if you think about agriculture, it is emitting 1/3 of the overall GHG. So in terms of a sector, it is quite big. So that is what we intend to do. We provide the loan, and through the loan, we try to reach the last mile. In my current role, I basically focus on ensuring that IFAD as an institution is also fulfilling its climate responsibility. So you cannot necessarily disconnect climate from agriculture, agriculture from climate. Of course, you know, as we face the consequences of climate change, we are now increasingly exposed to risk of reduced production. And that can create havoc in the international economy, but at the same time, national economy. So my role is to ensure that 40% of what we invest in developing countries in form of loan can be qualified as climate finance. And we use MDB methodology for that qualification to take place. So I get involved in the project design. I also track the progress that we are making across various different countries to ensure that climate is mainstreamed. We also have an indicator that focuses on adaptive capacity, which essentially means that it is not just the climate finance that we are deploying, but are we actually seeing increased adaptive capacity for our smallholder farmers against climate change? So that is an indicator that we measure. 90% of our projects must demonstrate adaptive capacity. So in terms of ambition, we have quite a high ambition, and going forward, we are actually looking into further increasing that ambition to 45%. So currently we are at 40%. Moving on, we're going to be looking at 45%. We also have biodiversity as a key focus area. And within biodiversity, we have a nature-based solution finance target, which is 30% of our overall climate finance target should be focused on a nature-based solution. So my role is to also make sure that we are integrating environment, climate, and biodiversity, and not necessarily seeing them in isolation. My job is to demonstrate co-benefits between climate and agriculture, climate and biodiversity, biodiversity and environment. So we are all essentially swimming at the same lane, at the same pace, at the same time, rather than having disjointed approaches. I also look into new opportunities of working with the development partners to bring more co-financing. So for example, we have our own core resources that we deploy as loan, but I also identify or try to identify and work with the development partners on new co-financing opportunity. So one of the things that we are doing with the US State Department is something called Vision for Adaptive Crops and Soil. It's a $50 million trust fund facility that we are currently establishing. So here we are going to be focusing on resilient crops and resilient seeds. So very much aligned to climate. I also try to bring new things in the organization. So methane, for example, you will hear a lot of, I would say, positive noise about methane reduction. So we have recently started a program with the US State Department and Global Methane Hub to try to see how we can integrate this methane reduction objective in the design and implementation of the projects. I'm also leading the biggest adaptation fund. We have an ambition of mobilizing up to $500 million. It is called SAP Plus. It is targeted to the smallholder farmers. And as the name suggests, mainly focusing on adaptation. But we are blending the grant resources that we are getting from this adaptation trust fund. So it's a combination of loan and grant going to the government. So yeah, that's what I do.
Well, that's a lot. Really interesting. Thank you, Jahan. I think you touched upon a lot of the subjects I want to talk about next. First being your primary activity is concessional loans, right? So that means that you grant loans at a lower interest rate than the market would. So my question would be, given the 2023 year that we've witnessed with soaring interest rates, how did you manage to keep your interest rates concessional and affordable for the countries that you work with?
So we rely on donor resources. So they are the ones who are providing us with the resources, and these are coming as grant. And we are using this in order to provide the concessional loan. And the return that we are getting is reflowed back to the organization in order to kind of maintain our operation, but in the future also offer more resources. So the reason we can keep it at a concessional rate is because what we are getting from the development partners is essentially a grant. But we also borrow from the market. And when we borrow from the market, we offer the loan in terms of market rate. So whatever market rate is there at that moment. So some countries do not necessarily have access to the market. So we are essentially working as a facilitator to create that bridge between what they need and what we can provide.
Yes. Okay. Very clear. And one thing you also mentioned in your previous answer is reaching the last mile. So basically you work with countries, but your aim is to impact smallholder farmers. So there's quite a gap between, you know, working with the government and actually witnessing impact on a small village in a developing country. So how do you make sure that the fund that you allocate to the countries do reach that last mile?
Yeah, so our mission is laser focused. We do focus on the last mile. So when we are designing, we have a joint team, representatives from IFAD plus the government. Of course, it goes through a consultation process, but we make sure that our mission is there in the design document. And then we go on supervision mission, implementation support mission, midterm review mission, evaluation mission, project completion mission. So we do have checks and balances in place to make sure that money is being utilized for which it was agreed upon. But at the same time, we do impact assessment. So 15% of our total portfolio go through an impact assessment procedure. And we have a very robust impact assessment process. So that process essentially takes a sample, 15% of our total project that we have designed and implemented, and look very closely exactly what had been the impact and to what extent it is consistent with the mission or the original objective of the project that we had designed.
Fantastic. Can you give us just an example of a project that you worked on? I saw that you have, you know, different strategic objectives, which are increased production, increased market access, and greater resilience. Can you give us an example, sort of a success story that you have worked on?
Okay. Yeah, sure. So we have implemented a project in Kenya, and it is in Upper Tana Valley. So in the Upper Tana River, of course, the upstream side, what we had noticed is that there was a climate change that had an impact on agricultural production. And as a result, the smallholder farmers also started using more chemical fertilizer, and they were not necessarily practicing sustainable land management. So the water pollution had gone up because, of course, there is increased sediments in the water. But at the same time, there was more flow of water, what you would call water runoff, from upstream to downstream. And it was affecting all the industries that were relying on that water coming from upstream for their own production. So, for example, you have Coca-Cola industry that uses water, but if the water is polluted, it increases their price because they have to invest on treatment costs. But at the same time, it had an implication of all the smart farmers who were at the downstream level. So that was a problem. Increased sediments, high water pollution, and overall decline when it comes to productivity. So the way we had addressed this challenge is by encouraging the smallholder farmers upstream to practice sustainable land management. So for example, agroforestry. One of the beauties of agroforestry, and you can call it a nature-based solution, is that it can hold water, and also the sediment in the water also goes down because of the practices. But at the same time, we also offered low interest loan to the women, especially women-headed households, for them to adopt technology upstream. And we, as a result, had managed to reduce pollution in the water almost by 15%. And the flow of water without the sediment had increased by 47%. And people who were on the downstream, their income actually increased by 55%. And we also had seen new agricultural practices, including avocado, strawberries, etc. So people also found new ways of increasing their income. And because it was such a sustainable model, because the industries that saw the benefit of encouraging the upstream farmers to practice sustainable agriculture, they actually decided to create their own fund. So even though this water fund that we would call was relying on IFAD resources and also resources blended with GEF, this is the Global Environment Facility, the industries saw the benefit and they created their own water fund. And that water fund is now self-sustainable. So the ultimate impact had been that we saw that farmers' income, as I said, was increased by almost 55%. We saw that 160,000 households got benefit out of the overall project. So I think if you take it from a holistic point of view, all three objectives that you had mentioned, resilient, increased income, improved practices, they had all gone up through this particular project.
Fantastic, really inspiring. And I think it also shows how, you know, nature-based solutions can also create income, which is, I think, kind of the hard things to do with nature investing. How do I get a return? But this is a great example of how that can create additional income and as well as sustainable social impact. So that's a great example. Thank you for that. I want to wrap up the podcast with a little career advice. As you know, I'm part of the MSc Climate Change Management and Finance at Imperial College. So I'm part of a cohort of 160 students who all want to work in climate finance and possibly, you know, international climate finance. So what would be a career advice that maybe you wish you heard when you were 25 and a student?
Don't see climate in isolation. See climate in relation to other sectors. That is super important. So climate itself, addressing climate itself is not necessarily going to make a huge difference when it comes to countries' ambition to grow. So it's important to see climate in relation to, you know, what other sectors that are there that are engine of growth, how they are going to be impacted, and how can you mitigate the risk of total disruption. So that's one. Second, I would say that it is very important to gain country experience. Learn from the countries, and the only way you can learn from the countries is by being with the countries on the ground. That foundation is super important, not only to learn more about climate, but how actually a country operates. What are the challenges? What are the bottlenecks? What are the opportunities? How does the system actually work? So whatever advice you give in the future, they are grounded on the reality. So that country experience, I would say, is absolutely critical. And third is be more open-minded in terms of the career that you want to choose. Just because a particular career opportunity does not necessarily mention climate doesn't necessarily mean that you will not be able to contribute. So for example, if you want to work as a banker, or you want to work as an asset manager, or you want to work as a teacher, there's always an ability for you to bring climate with you. So kind of bring the change within. Sometimes it's easy for us to like see things from an external perspective, but I think it's important to gain experience and understanding of the system as a whole and start bringing the change within. So if you're, let's say, an investment banker or an asset manager, what kind of changes you would like to see in those organizations when it comes to the delivery of their net zero transition plans? So sometimes it would be a direct impact, but I would say that when you're starting your career, be open-minded, be flexible, and also think about the indirect impact you could make.
I love that idea to keep an open mind and also remind ourselves that we can actually integrate climate into activities. Really, really good points. So thank you for that, Jahan. I think it's the perfect conclusion to this podcast. It's been a pleasure discussing with you and learning from your rich experience. So thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
And to everyone listening, I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed exchanging with Jahan. If you'd like to hear more insights, more subjects, and more professionals, don't forget to subscribe to the Imperial Business Podcast. And if you have any suggestions, or if you know the perfect guest for us to interview, please drop us a message at podcast.greenminds@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and see you soon.